Hey there, welcome to the Creative Classroom Podcast. I'm your host, John Spencer. I'm a former middle school teacher. I'm a current college professor, and I am passionate about seeing teachers transform their classrooms into bastions of creativity and wonder. And lately, we've been talking a lot about how to make this happen in virtual and hybrid spaces. And it's a topic that I got into in my most recent book, Empowered at a Distance. And I just want to say thank you to anyone who picked up that book. It was really cool to see the book hit number one in two different categories on Amazon, which was way cool. It's been the number one new release in experimental methods under education, and I've just been blown away by that. If you read it and you liked it, I would love for you to post a review. That would be super helpful, and it would just be awesome if you could do that. So if you haven't checked it out, go check that book out now. And I want to get into a topic that I get into in a more in-depth way in my book. And it's this idea of what it means to empower students in a community. You know, how do we create a classroom community of empowered learners when you have a distance learning class? And, you know, if we think about it, during this quarantine, during this pandemic, many students have described feeling lonely and isolated. It's been really hard. This disconnect is amplified in distance learning courses that are designed with the individual in mind. And this occurs when students access like an asynchronous class and watch videos and read articles and complete assignments in a personalized way, but where they're at the same time not actually interacting with the people around them. It also happens when students attend a synchronous meeting and turn their cameras off or their microphones off and just listen to their teachers. Without a physical classroom, a student can way too easily just feel as if they're alone in their work and alone in the educational journey that they're on. And without peer accountability and a larger sense of belonging, it becomes way too easy for students to disengage from the learning. Now, we know from the research, for the last two decades, people have built on the research of Anderson and Garrison, who have shown that success in an online course is dependent on how a student relates to the content, how they relate to the teacher, and how they relate to classmates. When students fail to connect with their instructor or their classmates, they disengage. And we see this all the time. Now, what does that disengagement look like? It results in lower attendance, lower assignment completion, lower achievement. In other words, by every metric imaginable, students learn less and perform worse when they aren't connecting with the larger community. On a more human level, students need to connect relationally to their classmates and their teacher. They need to feel a sense of belonging. They need to be known and respected. And during this time of quarantine, it is especially vital that students feel like they're a part of the larger community. As a professor, I've witnessed the power of the cohort model. I have seen how, despite the distance, my cohort is a tight community, and that the virtual cohorts that we have, students lean on each other and trust each other, and they have grown into an empowered community. While I realize that I am a part of that process, I'm keenly aware that the greatest factor in their success is the frequent peer interactions that have built in deeper learning and a deeper sense of belonging. And similarly, as a dad, I am struck by the way my own kids' teachers have designed experiences that build community in their distance learning classes. It's been pretty phenomenal to watch how teachers who have never been trained in distance learning and who would say, I'm new at it, I'm making mistakes, I feel like I'm a brand new teacher, I feel like I'm struggling, all of those things that you would hear, despite those challenges, and despite the feeling that they're not necessarily making a difference, I am watching that sense of belonging happen with my own kids. And I think we as educators tend to be way too hard on ourselves about this. I really believe that teachers are doing an amazing job building community. And their teachers have been intentional about community building in a way that has been a lifeline during this period of pandemic pedagogy. And so I want to explore some specific ways that we can build this sense of community and build empowerment into it. So I want to talk about seven different strategies for building an empowered community. These are some things that I've noticed from watching some phenomenal teachers, both in person, running hybrid systems, but also teachers that are teaching online. And this is based on interviews I've done with teachers and people I've talked to, and then also just experiments, ways that I've tried to build more ownership and self-direction into communities as well. If we think about student agency, you can visualize it as a continuum from less agency, or self-direction, which would be compliance, and then there's more student agency, which is where you get student engagement. But empowerment takes it beyond the level of engagement into this place of deeper ownership. And we tend to view that as an individual thing, but I also think that there is this collective element, this group element that can become a part of the whole makeup of the community. So I'm gonna share again seven different strategies for building an empowered community. Number one, spend more time letting students share their interests. On a fundamental level, being a part of a community involves being known. This includes sharing one's story and identity, but sometimes it's not safe to share your identity. This is true for, when students are part of a marginalized group. It's often true of students who are an ethnic minority. It's also true of students who are members of the LGBT plus population. And so it can be helpful to begin from a place where students can kind of control what they're sharing by beginning with student interests. Now, this can be done with things like a show and tell activity, which I love. Also, geek out blogs or geek out projects, Wonder Day projects. I've spoken a lot about those kinds of ideas, but all of those are ways to build on student interests. So the first thought is to be known and to be empowered begins with incorporating student interests into what you do, giving them voice and choice in their learning. Second strategy or second big idea is to launch a democratic leadership team. Collectively, we can honor student agency by bringing students into the planning and decision-making process. One way to do this is with optional virtual student leadership teams. Think of it as a planning session with your students rather than your colleagues. This process is designed to be entirely democratic. I first began democratic leadership teams in my third year of teaching middle school. I invited any student who wanted to give feedback and share ideas to join me Wednesdays at lunchtime. And to my surprise, I had a real mix of students. Some were gifted, some were labeled as special education, they were exceptional learners, some were ELL students, some were doing really well in class, some were struggling. Certain students were shy, others were loud, some were stellar students, others were struggling. You get the idea, it was a mixed group. But each one of them had a voice, and that was important. With a democratic leadership team, students are not selected for the team by a vote, right? So this is not a popularity contest. There's no application process, right? I did away with the application process. I just said, show up with lunch and join me. And I specifically invited students who I thought needed to have more of a sense of belonging to be a part of it. And this is how we ran things. This is a quick, update of the agenda. I would do an individual check-in. Each student says one high, one low, one random fact about themselves. That was followed by open feedback on what's going well. Then, open feedback on what could be improved. And then a space where they could share their ideas. And then after that, I would ask for feedback on a specific idea that I had. So specifically getting feedback on an idea. Then we would do some decision-making. We might decide about a unit plan or a project or some kind of thing like that. And then a phase where we could summarize and clarify together. A democratic leadership team meeting does not require you to, you know, give up control of your classroom altogether. You know, ultimately, you still have the say as the educator and as the leader of your classroom community. But it is a chance for them to feel a sense of ownership, and not just feel a sense of ownership, have some ownership. They're specifically giving vital feedback and making collective decisions. And I found that it really builds a sense of empowerment and ownership. Now, I will admit that this requires some extra work. It's voluntary and it has to occur outside of scheduled classroom meeting times. But I've also seen teachers run democratic classroom meetings during advisory periods or during required open office hours. Some of them will actually do this during class time, during the synchronous class meetings that they're having. So, you know, it doesn't have to be something you add to your plate. It can be something where you're taking something else off the plate and you're replacing it with a democratic leadership meeting. Idea number three is to have students negotiate the norms and procedures. So have them come up with the class norms on active participation, communication, being prepared, staying on topic, completing their work, all of those different class norms. And they can also create the class procedures. I have a video explaining how I negotiate class procedures with students so that they can come up with the class procedures and we together can negotiate these in a student-friendly way. Idea number four is something that I think a lot of primary grade teachers do a phenomenal job with, but I actually think secondary teachers can do this too. It's having student jobs. In a physical classroom, students might collect papers, organize supplies, take care of the calendar. And when this happens, students have a greater sense of ownership and responsibility in the classroom community. In a distance learning class, we can do the same thing. We could have tech geeks who help solve tech problems, a classroom reporter who shares ideas with parents and guardians and families, a quality assurance manager. There's all kinds of different jobs, a chat moderator, a discussion leader, tech help, communications director, all kinds of different ideas. And what you can do is just generate a list of jobs that students could be doing that you've been doing for them. Have them go out and, you know, get some volunteers who can find some technology tutorials and have them curate a document with technology help and share that document with students. Idea number five, make synchronous meetings more interactive. Now, I have a whole podcast on this, a whole blog post on this, but this is the idea of doing SEL check-ins, doing movement, silent reflections, breakout rooms, making those synchronous meetings packed full of moments where students can be interacting with one another rather than just talking by yourself. And this can be a challenge. I mean, we've all had those moments where you're teaching to blank screens and microphones are off, videos are off. It is a challenge. But the more we can build that ownership into it and structure it so that they can have those interactions with each other, the more it becomes normal, high interest, and there's less of the pressure to be on all the time as a teacher. And there's less of a likelihood of just students listening to you the whole time, right? So it's the idea of trying to keep it as interactive as possible. That being said, you might still have half of your students not show up. You might still have students showing up with, you know, microphones turned off and videos turned off. And those are very real challenges. But the more we can design it to be interactive, the higher the likelihood will be that they'll have a sense of ownership in that classroom community. Idea number six is to design collaborative projects. And this is the idea of creating low-risk projects. So one of the things that happens is, you know, student collaboration falls apart when it's too high pressure, where a student feels like they're carrying the whole group for them, where they're always being graded. But if you can create high-interest, low-risk mini-projects, that's a great first step for building collaboration. I recently did this writing prompt, but it's really like a mini project prompt where students design a utopia and then they have to determine how that utopia becomes a dystopia. And that's the kind of thing that they could easily do on a collaborative Google Doc. I mean, it doesn't have to be super complicated, but they could also create it in something like Minecraft. So there's a lot of different ways that they could approach it, but it's the idea of designing low risk, high interest, small collaborative projects. And then the final idea, number seven, is to use frequent check-ins to connect with students individually. So even though these ideas are all about the collective whole, it's the idea that by doing frequent check-ins, and I have a whole blog post and podcast on ways to improve student check-ins, but the more we can do those check-ins and increase the frequency of the check-ins, the more students will feel known and valued and respected, and that will help create that sense of ownership within the whole class community. So those are seven different ideas. Thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful day and go out and make something awesome.